So here we are with episode 4. And this time we're talking ocean conservation with some incredible experts on the Island of the Gods. We really did meet some amazing people in the ocean conservation space while we were in Bali. And Delphine was one of them.
My name is Delphine Robb and I'm originally from France. I was born in the suburb of Paris. That's where I lived most of my childhood. My father died when I was 5 and a half. And he was a pilot. And for the rest of my childhood, things like this, I always thought that I will at some point enjoy the privileges he gave me, which is the very cheap flight tickets from Air France. So when I finished my study, then I went to travel around the world for almost 2 years. I studied agronomy. So biology, I'm an engineer in biology. And then when I traveled around the world, it was like to find myself, let's say, and also find a place to start a life, I think. And I found Gili Trawangan in Indonesia. That was recommended to me by someone who I met in Burma. And she said, it's brilliant, you're going to love it for the diving and the horses. She knew I loved those two things. So I came to Gili Trawangan and did my dive master and diving instructor course. And then got a job as a diving instructor in Big Bubble Dive. And so I had the excuse to tell the family that I was not coming home because I got a job. So that's when with some of my friends, honestly, on a drunken night, we said, we're going to save the reef. And we found the BioRock technology. And there was a workshop a couple of months after. So I joined the workshop because my friends, one is a photographer, the other one is more like financial. So I was the scientist. So I went to meet the two scientists who invented the technology, Tom Goro and Walt Filsberg. After setting up our first BioRock reef in Gili Trawangan, Tom and Wolf contacted me that they wanted to organize an international workshop on Gili Trawangan to show the TV production, TV5, that we were a new place. The old place will be Pemuteran in northwest Bali, and then new place, Gili Trawangan. So that's how I joined the Gili Co Trust, because to organize a workshop, you need a lot of fundings previous to organize everything. And the Gili Co Trust at that time was doing a couple of projects, but not that much. So it would, all the dive shops agreed that we would do that and that I would work voluntarily for the Gili Co Trust and do the BioRock workshops. So everyone will get a BioRock during the workshop. But then at some point in 2008, we had to start with cleanups and waste management and trying to find solution for the rubbish on the island, but also the rubbish coming through from the sea or from the rivers and then in the sea and then on our beach. So and until now, we're still doing all these projects, also new projects like for the turtles, marine turtles and marine debris. So that includes a lot of education and being part of the community.
She told us a little about the issues Bali is facing in the ocean conservation space.
There's a lot of destruction because of the building and so the tourism. There are some people investing here the proper mindset and they want to do the things right. They will use a bioseptic tank. They will try not to like to build around the trees. They will try to use solar for the energy or anything that could help, rather than using only the main grid, which is in Indonesia only from petrol. Some are also very eco-conscious, so separating their waste, but that's a minority. And often even people investing and, you know, they're going to meet with me to know as much as they, the island, the history or how it works and things like this. But then they're going to look into a sustainable solution for building and eco-friendly. And then they often choose the cheap option, which is destruction. It's really hard to balance tourism with environment because you get you get most of the donations and the fundings from tourism. You don't want too much of the tourists because they're destroying the island. And then more tourists means more investor. And in the end, there will not be much green on the island, but a massive hill of rubbish. It's hard to explain. I think when people come here and they're volunteering or doing, even if it's just one day doing the tours we offer, they can really see the impact of tourism, but also the impact of everything we're trying to do. Unless I win the lottery and I buy the whole island and then I put some limits.
So mass tourism causing destruction on land and on the beach are major problems, as well as people being short-sighted and short-term in their thinking. And COVID made a huge difference to the ocean recovering. We also met Andre after hearing about him from tons of different spearfishers around the island. This guy is famous in the Bali spearfishing world. We kicked off by asking him to tell us a little bit about him.
I started commercially in year 2000. That is my first year 2000 commercially. Before that, I just make spear gun for myself. My family have furniture business, so that's why I can make. I know woods. Yeah, mostly my gun is from thick woods. So yeah, I'm originally from Bali. I born here. Yeah, so I diving since when I was when junior high school. When I was like 12, yeah, I start.
And how did you get into that? Did someone teach you?
Yeah,
did, yeah,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
who was that? Okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
My uncle, like spearfishing. Yeah, by that time I still kid, so I just follow him, and then it looked interesting for me. Yeah, and then after that, yeah, I start more and more intense. So when I finish high school, I learned my English in Australia for 1 year, and when I'm back. And more effort. Yeah, so just diving every day. Yeah, spearfishing everywhere around Bali, like 4 or 5 times a week.
Wow.
Yeah, by that time, I still young, no married, single.
He told us how sad he is about the ocean changes that have been happening in recent years.
Yeah, I've seen a lot. I feel so sad if I see people go around, throw rubbish, and then especially in Indonesia, 70% of our ocean is bombed out from explosion, cyanide. They overfish from bombing. They bomb a lot. I feel so sad if I go to area that I can still small fish die everywhere from bomb. Yeah, so sad. They just think today, not think future, not think the legacy. So they just think today, they earn money for living. But I told them, okay, if I say, but you can do something, you can do, yeah, but they said to me, or most of the time, is no infrastructure.
And how ocean bombing is affecting all ocean life and not killing fish in a sustainable way, as spearfishing can be said to be.
It's many variations, not TNT, they make their own, okay. Yeah, from bottle, like a beer bottle, whatever bottle, they put all the explosive there. This is, they can, but they mix together like.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Like fireworks?
Yeah, something like
okay,
that.
Okay, like the yeah. Same stuff that they put in those. Okay.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Depend how big, but sometimes they can be small, like a Red Bull cans that is small. The big one can be like a beer bottle, the big one, and can be bigger. Yeah, and then put down. Sometimes they have the
fuse.
Yeah,
fuse. Like a fuse line. Okay.
Yeah, that is on the surface, but they can use a cable.
That's an
issue. Yeah, and then they use a battery to trigger.
Wow.
Yeah, and boom, the radius you can hear underwater maybe kilometers away, maybe 2-4 kilometers away.
And then that's killing everything.
That's killing radius. I can say. One bomb that is big as the beer bottle, the big one, 20 meter gone. The radius 20 meter, all the fish gone.
For Andre, clearly ocean bombing and poisoning is the biggest threat to the coral and the ocean in Bali. And he believes that education is key. Delphine also told us why turtle poaching is an issue in Bali.
Oh, they sell the eggs. Indonesian people think the eggs are really good for their belly. So they're most of the time looking for the eggs to sell them at the market. Once, and then the second issue is a lack of education or ignorance. They think it's good to keep the baby turtle into a bucket or a tank until it's strong and big enough, which is not. Baby turtle needs to struggle on the beach to get the ability of the internal compass to be able to come back to that beach to lay eggs in their adult life. So if they don't have those few minutes on the beach and going straight into the sea, they will never be able to come back to where they're born if they make it.
She's working in coral conservation and told us how people can help with that.
So they can, if they're here, they can join the tour, they can give a donation. We don't really sponsor a piece of coral. It's more like if you want to sponsor a reef, then it's around, let's say, between 10 to 15 million, depends on how they want to, what shape they want to make, how many rebars we're going to need to use. We made one in memory of Daivu here. Their parents, like, instead of collecting flowers at the funeral, they collected money to buy a reef for Michael. We made an M, like a tunnel, that's already full of fish and coral. And it will be there for, you know, years, million years, because it's growing calcium carbonate. And then we receive donations through Global Giving, directly through WISE. So people can email me and tell me, like, I would like to give donation for that. And I will make sure the donation goes there.
Michael, who runs Big Tooth Spearfishing, was one of the first spearfishers we came across. And he told us how spearfishing can be a sustainable way of feeding ourselves.
So spearfishing is a little bit different than the freediving. It's more like hunting, but not like fishing. We cannot doing overfishing for spearfishing. It's really like we choose what we want to eat. And then, we're not like a killer machine or something. We just appreciate the ocean and take what we need on.
And Delphine backed him up with some ideas for how we could travel Bali sustainably and see ocean life while we're there.
If you're coming to Indonesia or anywhere in the world, just, or even if you're staying at home, you don't have the chance to be on holidays, you can still help, you know, as an individual. Do not hope that big companies or politicians are going to change the thing by taking like green, going towards green or blue strategies. Is like, do your best where you are. Like, do your bit every day. Beach clean, organize any land clean, organize clean up anywhere, and how you can get into the eco-warrior community or eco-conscious community. And then if you're coming in Indonesia, which is where my heart is like really try to raise awareness towards the local community by showing the good example. So do not take a plastic bag anywhere you are. Refill your water bottle. Do not take any broken coral or seashells from the beach because they're going to make the sand. So do not increase the beach erosion. Give a good example while you're here rather than just, you know, enjoying and so destroying at the same time. Just trying to be eco-conscious at home, but also on holidays, and then join any movement that you meet and then give donation for sure for the people you think are doing a good job so they can carry on.
We also visited a wonderful turtle sanctuary to find out what they're up to and how they're helping with ocean conservation. And they were kind enough to show us around.
Yeah, this is board. It's like some general information for our visitor, for our customer as well. Also, we have like a program to adopt and adopting and release the sea turtle. This is also helping us to for the, our injured turtle, for other turtle we rescue from the wildlife. And then the main our activity in daily is we try to stand by to helping sea turtle into the sea because they get some injured by the, for example, propeller, trapped by net, some they have a problem with the hook, and some turtle swallow the plastic bag. From a 7 species, we have 6 species in Indonesia. And then 3 of them we can see in Bali. For example, green sea turtle, hawksbill. This one is hawksbill. And then we have olive redly. The most common in Bali during April to September, this is olive redly. We can have a look at the olive redly over there. Yeah, olive redly is the smallest turtle from 6 species. They just can grow up maximum 45 centimeters. There's the juvenile, the young turtle. Yeah, the hawksbill is, I very love it, this one, because they're very beautiful shell. Most of the hawksbill lost their life because the shell, the people sealing the shell for our fancy thing, like sunglasses, fancy guitar, and making for the cell phone case, for example.
Our guide talked us through how the culture of Bali affects the conservation of turtles and his motivation for working with wildlife like this.
The thing we do is the very important is we try to stop the illegal trading. Because before Bali is popular with turtle smuggling because they have, first they have a culture about the ceremony we call the sacrificing ceremony. And then people who have a business, they use the issue they use the issue from our culture. They're collecting more turtle. They say it's for the ceremony, but exactly they don't do that. They just hunting the turtle just to get the money and then get hunting, selling the meat and the shell, for example. And then we found a solution to stop them. They're not allowed anymore to hunting the big size turtle for the ceremony. They allowed still do a ceremony. Have to all the turtle has have to grow up from the conservation, and then they have maximal size like a 15 centimeters, and they have to bring like a legal paper from the government, and then we knows how much the turtle needs for the sacrifice ceremony. Before, Bali is killing more than 10,000 a year, and then now we knows the this ceremony just needs less than 100 for a year.
So they're trying to provide poachers with alternative skills and jobs to stop them poaching illegally. He also told us how tourism is affecting turtles in Bali.
Some turtle lay egg into the close by the restaurant or under table the restaurant. Yeah, because some turtle they lost their nesting area, and then lots of people start growing up. A special place for their life, for example, like a private villa, it's a very fancy restaurant, for example. And then exactly this place is the nesting area for sea turtle. We get lots of rescue from people because the turtle lay egg close by the restaurant or, for example, beach club as well. And then every night on the season, start from April, September, we stand by for 24 hours to collecting the sea turtle. Exactly, we don't want to collecting the sea turtle. We want their hatchling on natural light. But this is very dangerous for their nest because some places too busy by a people activity, especially in Bali, tourist activity. And then we collecting, we put into our semi-nature hatchery for 45 to 16 days, yeah.
So they're saving turtle eggs from the beach and keeping them in a hatching area at the sanctuary before they're released. And it's great to know that we can donate money and be part of the turtle release. And he also told us other ways we can help, like volunteering.
For sure, they can. Minimum, they can do 3 days because 3 days, we think, is correct duration for them because they can see our daily activity. They can see our monitoring activity. They can see also, for example, like collecting the seaweed, because we have the green sea turtle here. We also go to the sea for a diving, collecting a seaweed, and directly feeding for the giant green sea. This program starts from April to September.
We also spoke with Sean, who started a beach clean movement in 2013 and has a major passion for cleaning up beaches so that turtles have a safe place to lay their eggs. She told us a little bit about how she ended up in Indonesia originally.
I worked for a charity back in England, and it was kind of however much money you raise for a charity, you can get money put into like a virtual gap year traveling thing. So I ended up putting their little project out of business because I got the whole trip paid for, which was wonderful. So I ended up in Indonesia for a 6-week trip to do a coral restoration course and my dive master internship. But because I already had my dive master course, I just kind of got 6 weeks of volunteering with the Gili Eco Trust. And from that moment onwards, I kind of knew that the Gili Eco Trust was definitely in my lines of what I wanted to do for a job. I just had to, work as a dive instructor and get a bit more money and experience and everything within the Indonesian culture to then be able to move over to the Gili Eco Trust.
Anne filled us in on the threats and problems in turtle conservation.
We get hawksbill turtles and green turtles nesting on the Gili Islands. Each of them lay approximately 80 to 120 eggs. The ones that we've managed to count, if we've actually been there in the evenings, have been around 90 or 100. So they are laying heaps and heaps of eggs. Of those, usually 80% will hatch, 80 to 90% will hatch. And then, the limits get a little bit less as they get to the water and as they kind of drop off with survival rates and things. And that's just being pushed a lot more to its vulnerable limits by human activity, whether that's on the beach or pollution in the ocean. One of the main things that we do see, which is a big issue, is called head starting. So it's a term which is used for any baby turtles that are kind of kept in aquariums or shallow tanks or glass buckets or just regular plastic buckets. And there's a bit of a misconception in Indonesia that turtles, because they're so small and they're so fragile and they're so vulnerable when they are born, that they need kind of help and they need to be looked after for between 6 and 18 months before they're allowed into the sea. So this is, I can also agree with this because they are super vulnerable and there are so many predators out to get them. But just because turtles have remained unchanged and unevolved for millions of years, we do know that, before humans came about putting them in tanks, then they were doing a pretty good job beforehand, probably better than they're doing now. So, this head starting, it kind of became popular in the 90s in Indonesia, especially because the government put some laws in place to say, we've got lots of turtles. We know that turtles are becoming endangered. So how about let's keep them in tanks and keep feeding them and keep looking after them until they're big enough and then we can release them. The hardest thing to see and to witness is that the majority of the head starting projects that are in Indonesia are doing it in the turtles' best interest. They know or they feel how vulnerable they are, so they do want to protect them. Some of them are there purely as a kind of tourist trap, but I think largely a lot of them that I visited and talked to the owners of them, it's just generally that is the education they've been given and that is what they're, undeniably trying to protect the turtle population. So that's super hard across Indonesia to be able to change these views because we're kind of saying, instead of you babysitting them and looking after them, just, throw them in the ocean, let them go there on their own. And unfortunately, a lot of them will die because of predation and all of the other things that they're up against, but they do have a much better chance going, straight from their little burrows that they make and running out down into the sea and doing it themselves. So we've set up, we've got some kind of trainings and things which we do with tourists and most importantly, the local businesses that we have on the island, the beach bars and things. So if they do find any turtles, either coming up the beach to nest or to when they're actually hatching, the best thing to do is absolutely nothing, which is really hard because, even a footprint in the sand can topple a little baby hatchling over and it will take them a good 3 or 4 minutes of wriggling to try and rewrite themselves to then carry on dashing down the beach. So it's quite painful to watch that because, you really want to help them and I want to help every turtle, but if they can't flip themselves out of that, then they're probably not going to be able to run down the beach and then, you know, swim across the reef and dash out to the sea. So all of it is a bit of a character building test for them to just know, you know, how many difficulties they've got coming up in the rest of their life. So it's all a little bit of training.
So keeping turtles in captivity, even for positive reasons, is a no-go. Makes sense. She spends a lot of time in the Gili Islands now, and she's shared how difficult tourism is for the turtles there.
It's bittersweet because we definitely need the tourists here, obviously, for the economy, and then the economy is the ones that can protect the baby turtles. But the sheer lack of space that we have, especially on Gili Trawangan, we've only got 7.2 kilometres of beachfront. All of it beautiful, but a lot of it is now becoming more and more developed, whereas it used to be a case of you're not allowed anything on the beach, no big built structures, no sunbeds, no umbrellas and things. But as the law is quite slack, more and more people start to put their sunbeds and tables back on the beaches. They're starting to build semi-permanent structures, which, you know, within 6 months will turn into permanent structures. So it's just basically blocking off as much of the beach as possible. And out of the four hotspots areas that we had just on Gili Tea, we've seen an increase of walls being put up, like coastal walls, which will stop the erosion directly out the front of the business that have built the wall. Yet either side of it is kind of creating more and more erosion of the beaches. So not only are the walls blocking the turtles from being able to nest, but either side of it, where they've nested before, then we're seeing a mass erosion of the sediment and the sand. So some of the nests are actually washing away before they get a chance to hatch as well, which is quite heartbreaking.
Sian also told us how difficult it is to see the amount of plastic in the ocean that she sees in Indonesia. And Sian told us about the beach clean she organises with the community to try to tackle it.
We collect around 7,000 or 8,000 kilos of plastics just off the beaches every year. And the majority of that has drifted and floated rather than come from our island. So even though beach cleans are kind of seen as, you know, you're mopping the floor when the tap is still turned on. So we're definitely not creating the solution to the problem, simply because we don't have any river mouths which we can block up ourselves. But by inviting the local community, a lot of business owners will come, and especially lots of tourists. They come to a weekly beach cleanup just for an hour, and we can kind of sit down and have a bit of a discussion about why the pollution is here, what types of pollution that we find, and if this is common to what the holidaymakers or the businesses use frequently, then we kind of offer different solutions and alternatives to these plastics. So then, you know, up until that point, then hopefully from then onwards, nothing will enter the ocean after that. I started the beach cleans in 2013, and there are a community on the island with a job called a pemulung, which is like a waste collector. So they'll go through and scavenge from bins or from the sides of the roads or from the island dump and collect valuable waste. So plastic bottles and cardboard and cans and things like this. So I would always find a pemulung just before the Friday beach clean and tell them where the location was to make sure that they would come and take, you know, just those, maybe those three items away. So we weren't really able to recycle very much. In 2016, the Gilika Trust established a proper waste facility and a waste bank on the island. So it meant that we can donate the recyclable waste to the waste bank, which can then get sorted and processed and sent off the island. But it also gave a chance for the local community to create some employment out of it so that they can actually go to the beaches and to the streets, do these litter picks, bring their waste to the bank Zampa and get paid for it.
And she also gave us her top tips for helping out with turtles.
Whenever you see a turtle conservation centre, my mind personally goes instantly towards anywhere near the word conservation, but it is to just ask as many questions as possible. Hopefully people don't take them in an offensive way, but to ask, you know, really, why is the, you know, conservation centre set up like this? Is it ethical? Most places, you know, they'll truly believe that they're ethical. So just to ask as many different questions as possible, and research the place and research reviews and things beforehand before you go, just to make sure that you are not, you know, you're not paying money into a turtle release program where you'll get your own little baby turtle in a plastic bucket that's been sitting there for 3 or 4 days in that bucket waiting for a tourist to release it. It must be a most, you know, fantastic opportunity, but it's only pleasures and benefits the tourist rather than the turtle. So just to be really aware of, you know, what you're supporting, I think, is very important. Before you even are lucky enough to come to Bali or Gili's or places like that, then even in the home, it's just so shocking to know that even if we put things in a bin in England, there's still so much of the waste that, you know, they say it might be recycled. We hope it will be recycled. We're going to every step to recycle it, but generally that's not always the case. And maybe even your rubbish in Bristol will end up in a rubbish facility in Indonesia where it's been sold as recycling, but it cannot actually be recycled. And some of them then, it actually is a lot cheaper to buy mismanaged waste from Western countries than buying fuel. So a lot of factories in some of the islands in Indonesia will actually burn plastic rather than a slightly cleaner fossil fuel. Just because it's cheaper. It's cheaper to buy used plastic rubbish and burn that than it is other fuel. If you do find an animal, any wildlife in distress, then if it does benefit them from holding onto them to trying to be able to cut a fishing line or ghost net or, you know, metal cans or something like this, if they are entangled, then yeah, by all means, we are going to probably be touching wildlife and manhandling to their distress, which hopefully the longer term benefit is it won't be entangled in lots of ghost net fishing rope or it won't be injured by something. So there are definitely some ways that it is kind of inevitable to be touching and holding in things. It's more just when you see teenage turtles or, you know, pretty large turtles being held out of the water, they're so incredibly heavy that they can't even really support themselves out of water. So the efforts that the females go through to come up on land and to nest and everything, it really takes it out of them. So for us to then pick them out of shallow tanks just for a photo is also causing them quite a lot of damage. So it's bittersweet.
Listening for episode 5 of Bali Ocean Secrets. We'll be talking Balinese food and cooking, especially the ocean-to-table options that we have access to on Bali and its neighbouring islands. We loved our trip to Chenangan and met an amazing restaurant owner there who spoke to us about the meals he made. We went there pretty much every day, so listen next week for that. And make sure you follow and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Huge, huge thanks to all of our guests this time. Delphine, Andre, and Sean. Of course, we have our very own boat in Bali now. And if you want to get in touch with Gus, the captain of Bali Ocean Secrets, and take a spearfishing trip or a sunset cruise with him, you can go to Bali Ocean Secrets on Instagram.